Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 1st of September. First hour of our program today, we'll be talking about the president's address to the nation from the Oval Office yesterday, what he had to say about Iraq, the end of the operations, combat operations in Iraq. But we will be seeing challenges, ongoing challenges. We'll talk about the amount of money that was spent in Iraq, the loss of life, if anything good has come from those combat operations. And he spent a great deal of time talking about what we need to do is take on our most urgent task, which is to restore our economy and put the millions of Americans who have lost their jobs back to work. It made me wonder about the amount of money that would be available for that task or how much more money we will be spending now in Afghanistan. Will there be, as someone suggested last night, a peace dividend as a result of the withdrawal of combat operations? We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour, Professor Jason Brozek, who is Assistant Professor of Government, and Stephen Scharf, Professor of International Affairs at Lawrence University. And later in the hour, Professor Judith Yaffe, Distinguished Research Fellow, Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. I know probably all of you listening listened to the president last night, and you will have thoughts about what he had to say. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. And our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Jason Brozek, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. I think the president had a difficult task last night because this was a war that he was not in favor of, and it hasn't gone swimmingly well, and it has cost a lot of money in terms of just money and also in terms of the loss of human life. What kind of tone did he strike last night? Did you think that it was an effective address?
He did have a difficult task. I think there were two things that he had to do in the address last night. As far as tone, I think that he had to strike a tone that was measured and pragmatic and somber. Not difficult because it fits the administration's tone over the past few weeks. But we certainly weren't going to see a mission accomplished speech last night. Secretary of Defense Gates said as much in Milwaukee yesterday. He warned of premature victory parades.
Mm-hmm.
The message was more difficult. The big announcement itself about the end of combat operations was certainly no surprise. But what he did need to do in the speech was tie it to, first, Afghanistan, and second, he needed to tie it to some broader message about U.S. foreign policy. And I was a little surprised about what that broader message about U.S. foreign policy was. Overall, though, the speech was really, I think, a declaration of a moment in transition. And on that, in that sense, I think he hit all of the right notes, even though these formal sit-down Oval Office addresses are not President Obama's best format.
Mm-hmm. And what surprised you?
I was surprised at how explicitly he tied U.S. foreign policy interests and our strategic agenda to the rise of the middle class in the U.S. and economic strength in the U.S. Toward the end of the address, he really stressed the impact of the war in Iraq on the U.S. economy, but also the role of the U.S. domestic economy being strong and stable in our own foreign policy strategy and our foreign policy interests. And that surprised me. I expected him to tie this to a broader message about U.S. foreign policy, and I was surprised and interested and pleased to see him bring that around to the economic health domestically in the
mm-hmm.
U.S.
Do you think he did that partially for political reasons? It's a tough race ahead for a lot of Democrats.
Oh, sure. I think so. But I also think he did it. I think he did it because he believes it. And I was convinced during the speech.
He talked about the United States paying a huge price and how contentious an issue this was at home, which we forget because it's going on for a long period of time. Can we talk just in, we'll talk about human lives, which is more important, but in terms of money, this was an incredibly expensive venture. Are we going to have a peace dividend now that combat troops are out?
I think so. Well, if you remember back in March of 2003, Paul Wolfowitz promised that this war was going to cost about $100 billion and that oil revenue would pay for the reconstruction itself. Estimates that I've seen show that the war has cost about $3 trillion.
Unbelievable.
So I think that the end of combat operations in Iraq should certainly have a peace dividend, both a financial peace dividend, but there's also a peace dividend to be had from the focus that we can bring back to other issues. This is certainly not going to go away for the administration. Questions about Iraq are not going to go away for the Obama administration, but ending combat operations in Iraq allows them to turn their attention elsewhere, allows them to turn their attention to Afghanistan and turn their attention back to the domestic economy. One of the things that Obama said in his speech is that the transition will be difficult, but it's going to allow him to return to the most important responsibility of his administration, which is bringing economic health back to the U.S.
Right. Have you heard any more scoop on what the conversation was like with former President Bush yesterday? I would love to know a transcript of that.
All I've heard is that it was moments long.
Moments
long. I'm not sure how much can be accomplished in moments long. I thought the lines about President Bush in the speech were actually nice. I didn't think that an Oval Office address is the right place to openly, explicitly criticize the Bush administration. I didn't think it was an appropriate arena for "I told you so," and I thought the lines about President Bush were well placed. So I don't know what transpired in a moments long conversation, but I thought the lines in the speech were nicely done.
Yeah, not much in a moments conversation, I'm sure. What about his comments on Afghanistan? He did spend a lot of time talking about we should never lose sight of what is at stake in Afghanistan. I'd like for you to tell us what you think he thinks is at stake there, that we need to dismantle and defeat al-Qaeda and to break the Taliban's momentum. He obviously feels that a lot is at stake there.
Right. His explanation about Afghanistan in the speech, that this is an important war, a dangerous war. I thought the argument that despite the fact that Afghanistan is important and dangerous, I appreciated him saying that this is not an excuse for not following a similar model to the end of the war in Iraq. I think next summer, I don't know that we'll see the same speech next summer, but I think next summer we're going to see a similar announcement about the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan. I think what we're going to see in Afghanistan is a move toward regional diplomacy for most of the states in the region. Russia and China included, there's a strong incentive to have a stable government in Afghanistan. So I think we can get a lot of benefit out of leaning on regional diplomacy. And Secretary Clinton has said that as well. This is not something that would surprise the administration. This is a move that they're making as well.
He talked about open-ended war not serving the interest of the Afghan people and the United States as well. Is that a different kind of philosophy than what we've had? And will he face Republican opposition to the idea that wars should not be open-ended?
Most definitely. Absolutely. There's a line of thought that by giving a timetable for withdrawal, by giving an end date to combat operations, either we're emboldening the Taliban, emboldening insurgent groups in Afghanistan or in Iraq. The fact is, the data on the ground show that it's just not the case. That violence in Iraq has been lower than any time since early 2006. It's almost as low as the beginning of the war. So we're really seeing 2 years of sustained low-level violence, and the terrorist attacks, which are horrifying and still occur very regularly, are at a much lower level than in 2007 and 2008, when we were much more worried about civil war breaking out in Iraq. So I think we are seeing a slow simmering violence in Iraq. The question is what happens after the U.S. fully withdraws. One of the other things that Obama said in the speech last night is that he has strong respect for the Iraqi security forces, that they're better trained, they're more committed, and they have high morale. He's very impressed with the Iraqi security forces and feels like it's a responsible decision to hand over primary responsibility for counterinsurgency to the Iraqi security forces.
We welcome your phone calls. Join us right away if you'd like. Our guests are each with us for a half hour, and we are responding to what we heard from the president last night about the withdrawal of combat operations in Iraq. Here's our phone number. He also talked about the economy. He also talked about Afghanistan. Here's our phone number. Fill the lines. Let's chat about this. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. And the email address, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@WPR.org. We'll take your calls as soon as they come in. Rhonda Fanning is doing on-air production today, and so she'll be answering your phone calls and getting you on the air, because we'd like to hear what you think about this. The New York Times this morning said, and I wonder what you think about this, in many ways, the war made Americans less safe, creating a new organization of terrorists and diverting the nation's military resources and political will from Afghanistan. And then the other part of that question is, some were saying last night that the war in Afghanistan would be over by now if it had not been for the war in Iraq.
I think those are really fair questions. I've seen some research on the connection between troop levels in Iraq and the number of attacks and the number killed. There does seem to be a positive relationship. Whether that's made Americans less safe, I think, is a really difficult question to answer. Part of that is difficult because we're just not privy to a lot of information. So I think those are incredibly difficult questions to answer. One of the things that Secretary of Defense Gates said just this morning that I appreciated was that he was taking a very long view of success in Iraq. He was asked the question at a press conference of whether the war was worth it or not, and mm-hmm. he said I can't answer that. Historians will answer that someday. What confuses the issue, he said, is that there was a justification for the war in 2003 that turned out to be false. That muddies the waters a little bit for determining success or making a value judgment about whether the war in Iraq was worth it or not. And his answer, I think, is a very good one, which is that we'll let historians decide whether or not it's worth it. It's difficult to say that a war is worth it when we're in an era without without the big symbolic end to the war, without a peace treaty being signed, without troops coming home and kissing women on the street. We're just in a different era for the end of war, and it's more difficult to assess success.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls. Scott in Madison, hi.
Hi there. Hi. Hey, my question is that President Obama said combat operations were over in, just recently, but didn't George Bush, when he was president, say combat operations had ended in 2003?
Sure, that was the famous or infamous mission accomplished speech in 2003. What we're seeing now, as we go into the future, the short-term future, is that we're going to have about 50,000 troops left in Iraq, and that's about 90,000 less than when Obama took office in early 2009. Those 50,000 troops in Iraq are going to be responsible for three things. They're going to be responsible for training, educating, providing technical assistance to the Iraqi army, the Iraqi security forces. They're going to be responsible for partnering on some counterterrorism operations with the Iraqi security forces. And they're going to be responsible for protecting U.S. Civilians and diplomats who are working in Iraq and providing civilian reconstruction. So at about 50,000 troops, that's four brigades, they're called advise and assist brigades, plus an advise and assist task force. So we're looking at those through December 2011, at which point the U.S. is going to withdraw all forces from Iraq. Secretary of Defense Gates said the goal is zero, and to open an office of security cooperation at the U.S. Embassy, which is really similar to U.S. offices at U.S. embassies in the region and around the world.
And let's go next to, thanks, Scott, for the call. Tom is in Chicago. Hi, Tom. Right there, Tom. Hello, Tom is not there. We go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
I had two comments. I think, number one, our invasion of Iraq upset the balance of power and freed up Iran to pursue other things. And then, number two, it taught not only Iran but the rest of the world that the U.S. invaded the one country in the axis of evil that did not have nuclear weapons. If you look, North Korea still is free and has no intervention at all. And I think Iran recognizes that. And I think we had a bad lesson there.
Great comments, John. On the second comment, I think you're absolutely right that nuclear weapons are a game changer. Whether the U.S. chose Iraq as the target for intervention in 2003 because they didn't have nuclear weapons is an open question. But I think you're right, absolutely, that nuclear weapons are a game changer. Whether the invasion of Iraq upset the balance of power, I think, is also a really interesting question. One of the concerns in now that combat operations have ended is that we've opened the door for Iran to have a much bigger influence in Iraq, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out over the next couple of years. That as Iraq starts to move on its own, eventually forms a coalition government. The election was 6 months ago, and no government has been formed yet. As Iraq starts to move and take responsibility for its own politics and its own security, I'm going to be reading with interest the role of Iran in Iraq.
And does that worry you?
I don't know that it worries me as much as I'm willing to say that I'm concerned about it. I think that an active Iran working within Iraq could be dangerous. I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out. Iran hasn't had much of a role in the domestic politics of Iraq to this point. And I think it's an open question whether the reason for that has been the U.S. presence in Iraq or whether there's some other reason for that. I don't know the answer.
And isn't it kind of troublesome that it's been 6 months since the election and no government has been formed?
I think it is a little troublesome, if only because it seems so messy.
Yes.
At the same time, I'm willing to see the silver lining in that cloud, which is that there hasn't been a government for 6 months, and the country's still mostly functioning. The electricity's still running. People are getting more and more cell phones and televisions. It makes me optimistic that without a coalition government for 6 months, it's still on a path to progress.
So why have a government, huh?
I guess.
Let's pause for just a moment and we'll return. We're talking about the president's address to the nation last night concerning Iraq and Afghanistan and the economy. Our guests will have to this hour right now, Professor Jason Brozek, who's assistant professor of government, and Stephen Scharf, professor of international affairs at Lawrence University. Thanks, John, for your call. Lines are open if you'd like to join our conversation. Your thoughts about what the president said last night, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, August marks the 90th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. The 90th anniversary. We'll talk about the right for women to vote in this country, how long it was, how bloody it was. And that will be the second hour of our program today. This hour, what the president said last night about Iraq, we welcome him. Where are you this morning? It's a fairly major address. What did you think about what he had to say, his thoughts about restoring the American economy, about remaining 50,000 troops, non-combat troops who are in Iraq right now? What do you think about how this war has gone? The New York Times today said that, which is fairly strong here, that this was a war that was pointless in many ways. Would you agree that it was a tragic, pointless war? Or do you think it served a purpose? What about the money? You know, do you see a peace dividend here? And is there a way to use some of the money spent on war on bolstering the American economy? You know, we'll keep talking, but I thought you might want to talk about this morning. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. What is the role of Vice President Biden in Iraq right now? Is he still there today? He's supposed to be advising, assisting in trying to get a government together here, or what?
My understanding is he is still there today. He was there last night to make a speech, which was, I believe, his sixth visit in just a few months. He joked, and I thought this was funny. He joked that he may apply for Iraqi citizenship. He's been there. He's been there so much. I think Biden is an important player on the ground in Iraq. I think he's going to be there, and I think he's going to continue to be an important player in the political negotiations that may lead to resolving this. This now six month wait for a government to be formed.
And do you know what the hang up is with that government? Why is it so hard, or that non-government, to get this together?
The main problem is that there was no clear winner in the election. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki didn't win an outright majority, which would have solved the problem pretty quickly. So it's a negotiation among a lot of small parties, all of whom have a vested interest in the future of Iraq. I said earlier that the silver lining to that is that we're still seeing progress on the ground, despite the fact that the government is at a stalemate. I think the other silver lining to that is we're seeing a lot of parties with a lot of vested interests who are heavily invested in the political process itself. One of the things, speaking of Joe Biden, one of the things that Vice President Biden has said is that what we're seeing in Iraq now over the last 6 months is politics breaking out. And I love that turn of phrase. Instead of violence breaking out over the stalemate, we're seeing politics break out over the stalemate. And I think that's really fascinating.
Ron in Sparta, our next caller. Hi, Ron. Are you there?
Hello.
Ron? Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Yes, one thing that doesn't come out in the news very much, and I actually happened to find it. I don't know if I found it on the DOD website on the internet, but I'd like to know the number of troops that are protecting China's mining interest in Afghanistan. They have the largest deposit of copper in the world. China won the contract, and U.S. troops, I don't know if that's classified information, that U.S. troops and American lives are being lost for China's mining interest, yet China won't put any troops in Afghanistan. And I think that's a mistake. China should be responsible for taking care of their own interest, and we're saving the world again, saving the mining interests of Afghanistan with American troops. Thank you, and I'll take my answer.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Ron. I think your inclination that that's an impossible question to answer is right. In Afghanistan right now, we're looking at about 94,000 to 95,000 troops. And you're right that there just recently there was a discovery that the mining interests in Afghanistan are pretty substantial and pretty valuable. How that's being played out on the ground and whether there are troops dedicated to protecting China's mining interests, that's, I think, an impossible question to answer.
And thanks very much for the call. Just one final point, and then we'll go. We switch guests, same topics. Do you think that the president said enough, or is this the focus of another conversation from him? He sort of teased our interest in restoring our economy and putting millions of Americans who have lost their jobs back to work. He didn't say much about that or how it is that the withdrawal of combat troops will have a direct impact on putting people back to work. Was that a failing of this speech, or should he not have even mentioned that, or is that the subject of a forthcoming address?
I think he absolutely should have mentioned that. I think that was the opening statement of a conversation that's going to continue over the coming months. I think this wasn't the speech to have the conversation in detail, but this was the place to introduce the fact that we're going to have that conversation, and he's going to be speaking about it further.
Okay. Thank you so much. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to listening to the next half hour.
All right. Thanks. Our guest, the first half hour, Professor Jason Brozek, Assistant Professor of Government, and Stephen Scarf, Professor of International Affairs at Lawrence. Joining our conversation now is Professor Judith Yaffe, Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies, the National Defense University. We're talking about the president's address last night to the nation from the Oval Office on Iraq, and we're welcoming phone calls from you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address for you to join us, if that's your preferred way of communicating, is talk@wpr.org. While we're getting our next guest, which we have. All right, so I don't need to say another word. Professor Yaffe, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And let me just get your general response to the address last night. Was it effective? Did the president say anything that you thought was unusual?
No, I think it was the standard kind of speech. But there are two different audiences you have to think about. There's the domestic U.S. audience, to which this was all geared, which talks about us, our sacrifices, you know, what it's cost us, our timetable, et cetera, all of which is true and good. But it doesn't say anything about the cost to the Iraqis or what price they are possibly going to pay in the, or continue to pay. My point simply being is that this is a complicated thing to analyze if you consider the broader context. The argument is not so much how did we get there and why we have to do whatever, we've been there, and the issue is how do we do this with and do no harm at the same time.
What is the cost to the Iraqis?
Well, their politicians are, how does one describe it? It's a nightmare. Unable to agree, negotiate a government. This has been going on for, 6 months now or more? It may be they are almost at the end of Ramadan. Nothing much happens in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, during Ramadan. It's the month of, of fasting. So it is possible, as people have predicted, that when this is over in another week or so, and there's a huge three-day holiday in Eid, then they'll get down to business and everything will happen. I hope that's true, that then the negotiations, which have been going on, and the discussions, will finally, bear fruit. In the past, the Iraqis have shown an incredible ability to pull things together at the last minute and to move on. Let's hope that that can happen again. And if so, there's been a huge cost in, Iraqi lives. There's been a huge cost in treasure and a lot of things, but I guess the point I wanted to make was they're going to continue to go on paying. They're not asking us to continue that level of, pay for everything, but there's a recognition that, we're really doing this, and, are they ready? Do they have the political maturity as well as the security maturity?
Right.
Can they defend themselves? They're doing a lot better. But how they use that power and how politicized things, the whole situation could unravel. I don't think it will.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I've
you
always
don't.
Been a bit optimistic.
Uh-huh.
But it's a difficult time. But I thought, otherwise, I thought the speech was, about what he should be saying. I mean, I think it was a fairly true characterization. In this, in a sense, it was a very political speech. And he is really looking for a quality that's been missing in our policy towards Iraq and other issues, and that is consensus.
Mm-hmm. Would it have made much difference, do you think, if we had an open-ended commitment to Iraq? I mean, we're still there, certainly, but in terms of combat operations, would it have made a difference if we had stayed until we felt a little bit better about the future?
Well, short term, does it make any difference between, September 2010 and December 2010 or April 20? I don't think the short term changes make that much difference, because once you announce what you're going to do, everyone prepares for it. The Iraqis, all of them, have always known we were going to go at some point. It's almost a replication of what's happening in Afghanistan. Can you set a timetable? And can you say, at such and such a day, at such and such an hour, we will do the following? We will withdraw, we will draw down, we will do... You can do that, but you're also sending a signal to the people who want us out that, we can outwait them. And to those who've been working with us, maybe it's not a good idea to keep doing this. It could be risky.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've seen some of that in Iraq, and I think we've seen it in other crises, at other times.
And what are your thoughts about a possible transfer of a lot of money? This has cost, when we look at the figures of how much these wars have cost us, they're astronomically high. Are we going to just transfer more money into our operations in Afghanistan, or will there be a peace dividend?
I guess over the long time I've been doing this, I've learned never to trust a peace dividend. Because once, a peace dividend is like, I don't know if you remember this, when the sugar prices skyrocketed and everybody that used sugar raised prices because sugar was such an expensive commodity. When the market crashed and the price went down, those high prices stayed the same.
Hmm.
Now, when have we really seen a peace dividend? We don't have to spend a war on Iraq. Maybe some of it will roll into Afghanistan, but where does it go? It doesn't go anywhere. It stays where it is because the Pentagon, the government will look at, now we have to do replacement. We have to figure out how to improve and train and prepare for the next crisis. So peace dividends are an elusive thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls for you. We start with Al in Waupun. Hi, Al.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment and then a question for your guest. I've had a lifelong interest in the professional military of India, and I read their professional periodicals religiously, and they are very, very concerned about an American withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2012-2013. In fact, in something that has been widely underreported, the Indian military announced last month that they regard their number one threat to be China and not Pakistan. And they believe that the American presence in Afghanistan has forced Pakistan to redeploy much of their military against the Taliban and away from India. And they're afraid that if America withdraws from Afghanistan, that Pakistan will refocus their strategy against India. I'm curious to know what your guest thinks about that, and also what your guest thinks China's motivation would be as a participant in any regional peace talks regarding Afghanistan. I'll hang up and
talk to you.
All right, Al.
Thanks for the call. Professor Yaffe.
Well, that takes me way out of my league, or what they call it. It's not my area of responsibility. I don't feel smart enough to comment on what China's up to. I think that I do know enough to say, I think the caller's correct. If India is reassessing who its primary concern, security concern or enemy is, if you will, we've been trying to urge Pakistan to do the same thing for a long time. It's not all about India. Why do you keep preparing for the next war and it's got to be India? Why aren't you worried about, we've tried to tell them that you have other and greater concerns. But I don't feel smart enough to really comment on his questions except to say they're great questions and you have to find someone else to answer them.
Could we talk a little bit more, though, about Afghanistan? The president did talk about Afghanistan last night and how we needed to defeat al-Qaeda and dismantle al-Qaeda, break their momentum. And then he also talked about withdrawing from Afghanistan next August, a transition taking place there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what our end goal is in Afghanistan, and I'm interested in what you thought about the president's comments. Next August is not that far away.
It's not.
What's he going to do to change things?
I'm not really sure what he's going to do. More of the same. They're trying to apply, from what I can see, Afghanistan to what worked in Iraq. The problem is Afghanistan's not Iraq. Iraq has been a state with a government and an identifiable country for a long time. Afghanistan has been, what, in 30 years plus of civil war that have virtually destroyed the country, the concept of government, of institution. We're not just talking about institution building. We're talking about institution making. Again, I worry, as I said, when you start setting deadlines for an area where you haven't really quite defined the clear end state, and what are the risks and the opportunities there for us, I would worry about that because we're not dealing with the same conditions or the same reality as we had dealt with in Iraq. I don't know if the same strategy is going to work. I think General Petraeus certainly is trying to apply them. Maybe he'll be successful, but what do you do with a military that, I don't know, I've seen figures that it's, what, more than 80% illiterate?
Right.
Maybe 90% illiterate? The Iraqis certainly weren't illiterate, not anywhere near that kind of degree, with no training, no experience in this kind, the kind of effort we're trying to do. I think it's a very risky business, I guess, as best I can say.
Larry in Milwaukee, hi.
Good morning. Kathleen, I'm sorry I missed your first guest. He said something that directly contradicted a BBC report last night. The BBC had a long report on the electricity in Iraq and how it's not back to what it needs to be, that it's very scarce, and that the people in Iraq are very, very irked and upset with the Americans because there is no electricity. And your guest said, your first guest said that electricity is pretty good.
Yeah, he said that the infrastructure, you know, it's amazing that things were up and running considering there wasn't a government. Are you getting the same kinds of reports or more what Larry is receiving?
I don't know who your first guest was because I didn't hear that part of it.
He was a professor of international affairs at Lawrence University here in Wisconsin.
Okay, but I wouldn't be so optimistic. It's spotty at best, and I see daily reports on, you know, availability, and electricity is not on a 24/7 basis, and many areas are still only getting a couple hours a day, some better than others. Some projects are nearing completion. A lot of Iraqis still have to rely on generators, which means they have to buy that privately. So we don't have a perfect situation. But I think that a lot of the projects that were begun are long-term. They've taken a long while to come together. We had to rebuild an entire infrastructure, and there were security concerns. So I don't know what your first guest said. I don't think if what I... what you described, I wouldn't be that optimistic. There are two things which are priceless and precious. One is water, the other is electricity. 125 degree heat, and you don't have enough electricity for more than maybe a couple hours a day. It's off and it's on. And that you know, varies in degree in different areas of the country, but it's still certainly there. Water, there is still not a secure source of potable water, you know, water that's usable in a country that's been undergoing severe drought and has had the flow reduced by dams being built by its neighbors. So there's a real problem on both of these issues. Now, how do you tackle them? I think that the power thing, it's improving, but it's a slow process. The interesting thing, though, from the assessments I read is that there is more available, and there is no queuing for gas. So a lot of things, there have been improvements in sectors of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Larry?
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi. A couple of questions. Your guest alluded to the amount of suffering that Iraqis have had. And I remember a few years ago a rather well-publicized article in the British Medical Journal of the Lancet estimated that perhaps up to 1 million Iraqis had died during the war. Now we tend to see the figure 100,000 as kind of the one that is used by most people. I wonder if your guests could comment on that. And then secondly, one of the other things that Mr. Obama and the Republicans never seem to want to talk about is how many contractors are there in Iraq and how many will remain after a lot of our military pulls out and other mercenaries that we're paying for.
Good questions. On the casualties by the war, we're talking about 2003?
Well, actually, the entire time of the war period.
Well, but we're talking about 2003. We're not going back to 1991.
Correct.
A million is way too high, I'm sure, but 100,000 is probably the low figure. I remember the Lancet article. I don't remember all the details, but I'm not sure what they based all of that on at the time. The thing is, we're never going to know exactly how many. A lot of deaths went unreported. A lot of burials, according to Muslim tradition and law, must be buried, you know, within 24 hours. A lot of families would take the dead home. A lot of them don't know. But I think it's safe to say that you have a lot more than 100,000, but how much more? 150? Nobody's really going to, I think, have an accurate figure. But it's that high. On the contractors, wow, great question. Many contractors, and they will remain. And the contractors are not just hired by, you know, U.S. entities. The Iraqis hire contractors, American as well. I think you're right to ask the question. We won't be paying for all of them, or some of them. I have no idea. It depends who they work for. But contractors are going to be there. And they don't have to be withdrawn when U.S. combat forces are drawn down.
And thanks, George, for your call. We'll pause for a moment and return. We're talking about the president's address to the country last night on Iraq, the withdrawal of combat troops. He also spent time discussing the economy, the middle class in America, and, of course, Afghanistan. So your response is welcome, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program today this month marks the 90th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which, of course, gave women the right to vote. We'll talk about that long, long struggle, how it was finally achieved, our number two of our program today. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we're continuing our discussion of the president's address to the country last night on the withdrawal of combat troops. Some of the analysts yesterday were saying that if a government cannot be formed in Iraq and formed pretty quickly, that there is a great possibility that there will be a huge amount of violence and the outbreak of a significant civil war. What do you say to that?
I would disagree. You need to have a government. You need to have someone in charge. You need to do certain things that, you know, government requires. You need to keep politicians and politicization out of the military and out of the security situation. I think the Iraqis will come up with a government. Their inability to do so makes decision-making virtually impossible. But I also think that I lost my train of thought there. I have to do an instant recall. Let me come back to that.
All right. It'll come back at some point.
Yeah, sorry.
That's all right. What about the president's message yesterday concerning the middle class and this need to spend time now strengthening the middle class and finding jobs for Americans? Was that an appropriate place for him to go in this speech last night?
Well, I can't comment on the domestic sides or of what he said. You've got to get an independent pundit to do that. My own personal feeling is the president goes where he wants to go in a speech.
Mm-hmm.
And addresses what he sees as the current issues. You know, we are always in a state of election in the United States. The day after the last election, we go to the next one. Everyone is looking for sound bites, and they've got to be political statements. And that's why, when I started in the beginning, we do these things and it's all about us, but people outside of the United States listen and they hear different things. Some of them understand that the politics is here, but you know, we build the way it is read, I think, abroad. I think Iraqis especially concerned. What do you mean? You don't care about what happens here, what you started here, that events and developments have been dictated by your timetable and not what is best for Iraqi development. In other words, we force them, because of our timetable, to write a constitution in 3 weeks. We force them to have elections, to do a whole number of things within a timetable saying we've got to have this done before our next election.
And does that vary, would you say, Professor Yaffe, from country to country, the response to the address last night?
It probably does. I just, you know, that's, I can't, how can you answer a question like that? Of course it's going to vary, but I think most observers, or if you want to put it, most pundits abroad, I hate pundits anyway, are going to see things in terms of their own national interest. Do they understand politics? Sure, they probably do. But the way these things are interpreted are going to reflect the issues in their own country. The way, for example, Israelis will look at this will be different from the way Iranians will. Each one is going to interpret it in light of their own issues. Each country, each individual who's commenting thinks that they are the only thing that the United States is interested in. Iraqis long believed that our interests were totally focused. All our time was spent on them. The Iranians, however, know that all our time and interest is spent on them. Multiply that by how many countries, and that's where you get that many different points of view.
One of the things we talked about, well, let's go to phone calls. I'll get back to that. Jim in Colfax, hi.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to comment on the president's speech. I guess I found it to be quite unremarkable. And the other thing that I think was interesting, that he was quite magnanimous, kind to the previous administration, and looking, he didn't mention any of the reasons that were given by the Bush administration to get into Iraq. And I think the one thing that, if anybody was listening to it, needs to heed is that one number, $1 trillion. $1 trillion, and I think of what could we have done with $1 trillion. And the other thing I think that always sticks in my mind is the human cost, the cost to the wounded, the cost to the dead, our dead, and the cost to the Iraqi dead. And it's such a sad, sad thing that we even got into this mess. So I thought speech was unremarkable for Obama, and he was very kind. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
I had a similar observation. Unremarkable. Even Lincoln gave unremarkable speeches. If you the pundits of 18 when Lincoln did the Gettysburg Address, was what an unremarkable, boring, short speech compared to the 2-hour. Or oration by the other speaker. Let's let history decide that. The only thing I can think of. But I think you made some good points. I think that Mr. Obama may have made the decision. This is not the time and place to start or keep on arguing about why we did this, how they got us in there, and the mistakes that were made. All of that is there, but doesn't have to. And at this point, for him to deal with that again distracts from getting this issue resolved. I think he sees that there's nothing to be gained by going over that, especially in a 20-minute speech. People will do that. But that may not. This was not the time and place to do that.
One of the things we have about a minute left that we got into last half hour is our guest said that he was a little concerned that Iran would have now a bigger influence in Iraq. Do you share that concern?
No, I don't. Iran has a big influence. I think it's as big now as it will ever be. A lot Iraqis in a growing number are very concerned about what Iran is able to do, how it meddles, the influence it has and thinks it has, and the demands it's making. For example, Iran occupied an oil field on Iraqi territory. Iran wants things from Iraq that they can't and they wouldn't agree to. So they're not a total puppet. People are making a very simplistic an error based on a simplistic reading of, well, they're all the same religious sect. Therefore, Iran thinks it has a lot of influence, but Iran always overestimates and overplays its hand. So, no, that does not worry me. But they're there.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor Judith Yaffe, our guest this half hour, Distinguished Research Fellow, Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from NPR, and we'll continue and should have a really interesting conversation, hour number two of our show for this first day of September. This is the Ideas Network.